Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Newsmakers from America and around the world speak with journalists in an unscripted and unrehearsed discussion about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. Here is your host on this edition of Press Conference USA, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our topic on this edition of the program, the crisis in Ukraine and its impact on transatlantic relations. Our guest, Karen Donfried, president of the German Marshall Fund. That's an American think tank dedicated to strengthening relations between North America and Europe. And we're coming to you from GMF headquarters in Washington. We'll review recent events in Ukraine after Russia sparked a murky war against its neighbor earlier this year. Let's recall that hostilities broke out last year when former Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych rejected an association agreement with the European Union. His action prompted a huge outcry from a majority of Ukrainians who desired a closer association with the West, although not necessarily to the detriment of their long-standing ties with Russia to the east. Nonetheless, Russian President Vladimir Putin did not take kindly to what he perceived as a shift away from his so-called sphere of influence. Since then, we have witnessed Moscow's annexation of Crimea, which is an integral part of the Ukrainian territory. More recently, Russia has poured arms into eastern Ukraine, fueling violent separatists and a conflict that has killed thousands. Currently, a tenuous truce exists between these Russian-backed separatists and Ukraine, and earlier this month, the representatives of Kiev and the rebels signed a 12-point ceasefire protocol that included concessions to the separatists. Under the agreement, which was approved by Ukraine's parliament, the areas of Donetsk and Luhansk regions under rebel control will be granted temporary special self-rule status, including the right to set up their own police forces and appoint prosecutors and judges. Ukraine's parliament also approved a broad amnesty for many rebel fighters and protections for the Russian language. Sporadic fighting has continued in eastern Ukraine despite the ceasefire that went into effect on September 5th. In his recent address to the UN General Assembly, U.S. President Barack Obama underscored U.S. solidarity with Ukraine and chastised Russia for its destabilizing actions and for attempting to brazenly upend the post-Cold War order by annexing Crimea and destabilizing a sovereign nation. We'll talk with Karen Donfried about the latest in the Ukraine-Russia standoff and implications for U.S.-Russia relations and Russian transatlantic relations. Prior to assuming the presidency of the German Marshall Fund, Karen Donfried was the special assistant to the president and senior director for European affairs on the National Security Council at the White House. She is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and the American Council on Germany. Karen Donfried, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
Well, first, Karen, I'd like to get your assessment of this so-called ceasefire in Ukraine. Do you think Ukrainian President Poroshenko has the right balance? It appears that he seems to be bending over backwards, on the one hand, to placate Moscow by giving more autonomy to rebel-held areas, even at the risk of antagonizing pro-Western Ukrainians who felt perhaps he has conceded too much. What are your thoughts?
So there have been various elements of U.S. policy, and I would argue it's been a shared U.S.-European policy toward the Ukraine crisis over the past several months. A key part of the policy has been supporting Ukraine, both in terms of bringing Ukraine back to economic health and supporting Ukraine's political developments. A second key part of the strategy has been punishing Russia for its illegal annexation of Crimea and for the instability it's been provoking in the East, which you refer to in your opening remarks, and also isolating Russia, and that would be reconstituting the G7 and no longer having a G8. But those moves of punishing and isolating Russia have been combined with also making clear that there is a diplomatic off-ramp. President Obama has been clear in saying there's not a military solution, that there can only be a political settlement. And it's in that context that the ceasefire is so important, because the hope is that that ceasefire is providing the opportunity for a longer-term political settlement. I would agree with you that President Poroshenko has gone very far down the road in offering concessions in terms of how the East will be governed, the amnesty that you referred to, the other elements of that ceasefire. And the hope is that that can be the basis for a durable political settlement. But the jury is still out on that at this point.
Indeed, the jury is still out. And notwithstanding these major concessions, which have, to some extent, antagonized those who led the Maidan revolution, do you think Russia will abide by it? I mean, it seems to me that the onus is now on Russia and the rebel separatists to take this. Do you think they will? And if they don't, what does that say?
The policy of the Obama administration has been clear that if Russia doesn't live up to the terms of the ceasefire that it's agreed to, the sanctions will stay in place, and there's certainly the prospect of even stronger sanctions. We've now had several rounds of sanctions against Russia. I think the sectoral sanctions in particular, the financial sanctions, the energy sanctions, the defense sanctions, will take a significant toll on the Russian economy over time. So I think if you take a long-term perspective, there's no question that the U.S. and Europe and ultimately Ukraine are in a stronger position over time.
President Obama said, of course, there is no military solution, and I think most would agree with that. Nonetheless, in his address to a joint meeting of the U.S. Congress, Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko did ask for military aid and a special security status for his country. He said that the Ukrainian army needed more military equipment and that the non-lethal aid, such as blankets, night vision goggles, were necessary but insufficient. Now, we know that the aid that he requested has not been granted. Do you agree with the U.S. position on refraining from helping to provide this kind of defensive weaponry to Ukraine?
So the distinction you made is an important one. The U.S. is providing military assistance to Ukraine. It's non-lethal assistance. And the logic behind that is, I think, particularly at a time when you have a ceasefire in place, shaky as it is, do you want to take a step that might be seen as provocative? And let's see if we can move toward a political settlement. I think there's no question in anyone's mind that the Russian army is in a much stronger position than the Ukrainian army. And it certainly would be a tragedy were Russia to have a full-scale invasion across that border into Ukraine. And based on troop deployments that are there and the Russian military presence that we already see in the East, I think the focus at the moment really should be on the ceasefire, keeping that in place and moving toward a political settlement.
But certainly if Russia were in the U.S. position, they would feel no compunction in providing weaponry to their allies, just as a show of solidarity, not that the Ukrainians in this case would necessarily be using it in an offensive way. Again, you know, looking at Russia and how Russia sees the world and how it behaves, isn't this sending a signal that the United States and the West is just not going to go the mile for Ukraine in the end?
We have to ask ourselves, what's the long-term strategy here? And a lot of people have said this is a new Cold War between the U.S. and Russia. I don't think it's a new Cold War between the U.S. and Russia, because 25 years have passed since the end of the Cold War and where we are today. And the U.S. and our European allies thought that Russia had made a strategic decision at the end of the Cold War, that cooperating with the West was more in its interest than engaging in open conflict. Turned out we were wrong about that. And that's what the illegal annexation of Crimea shows. It shows through Russian military activities and other activities in the eastern part of Ukraine. But if we don't think there's a military solution to this problem, and if we also make the argument that this is not Ukraine making a choice between Russia and the EU, but rather it's about Ukraine having the democratic right to determine its own future and for Ukraine not to have a larger country take over part of its sovereign territory. Those are the principles that are at play here. And the argument that the Obama administration has made is Ukraine will have, going forward, a deep relationship with Russia. Cultural, political, economic. So we need to focus on finding a political solution. And that's what the emphasis has been. And that's why the concern has been that if you provide lethal military assistance, it could be provocative rather than helpful at this point in the conflict.
Well, you referred to miscalculation perhaps on the part of the West vis-a-vis Russia. And we know that for Russia, Ukraine is very important. It's, as President Putin likes to say, it's a part of larger Russia. I mean, he doesn't see it as a sovereign nation, and therefore he probably justifies his moves, even though he denies that Russia is there with troops and so forth, that is, in Ukraine. In that light, do you think perhaps the EU underestimated the impact this would have and didn't foresee Russia's reaction?
I'm not sure anyone foresaw Russia's reaction. Certainly the U.S. has been very supportive of EU engagement with Ukraine and was supportive of the EU negotiating an association agreement with Ukraine. And there have been several surprises along the way. I mean, one surprise was former Ukrainian President Yanukovych deciding not to sign the agreement and saying, I've got a better deal on offer from Russia, and I'm going to take that. The second surprise came when, in the wake of that decision, hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians demonstrated on the streets saying, we actually want Europe. The third surprise came when, early in this year, the three EU foreign ministers were negotiating what we thought was going to be a deal with then-President Yanukovych, only to have him then flee to Russia. And then the fourth surprise was the Russian illegal annexation of Crimea, and it continues from there. But I think we Americans, as well as our European partners, had been making the argument that a Ukraine that has a deeper relationship to the EU is in Russia's interest. Because if Russia has an economically stronger neighbor, then that's an export market for Russian goods. It's a better provider of manufactured goods to Russia. And clearly that argument was in no way compelling to Vladimir Putin. And he saw this very much as a zero-sum game, that a Ukraine moving closer to the EU is necessarily Ukraine moving away from Russia. And that was not acceptable to him.
Indeed, he sees it as a zero-sum game, and he doesn't understand the so-called win-win concept, evidently. But that said, it seems now we're seeing some protests in Russia itself, finally. Some citizens are protesting Russia's actions in Ukraine. Are we seeing some signs that this policy of aggression in Ukraine is going to backfire as the body bags of Russian soldiers come back and more people are questioning the wisdom of Russia taking these provocative moves in eastern Ukraine?
I definitely want to come to that question in a minute, but I also want to respond to your comment about a zero-sum game versus a win-win, because the irony here is if Vladimir Putin is most concerned about a Ukraine coming closer to the EU, and even more than that, a Ukraine that would join NATO, the result of his policies is almost the reverse. When you look at the EU's Vilnius summit last November, where Ukraine might have signed an association agreement and chose not to, there was not a lot of enthusiasm in the European Union for a deeper relationship with Ukraine. But what's happened over the past months has accelerated Ukraine's relationship with the EU. And if you think about NATO, Vladimir Putin has given NATO a huge shot in the arm if you look at the reassurance measures that have been put in place for existing NATO members, the Baltics, Poland, and Romania. So there's a real irony of what the upshot of Putin's policy has been. In terms of the Russian public, this is the big question. And this is why I said earlier, it's not the Cold War, because Russia has changed too in these 25 years. It's a much more open country. Russians travel. They like buying Western products. So will we see a backlash against Putin's policy over time? Now, we have to remember that Putin has extraordinary control over the Russian media, so the narrative that's being heard in Russia is not an objective one. But I think this is the question a lot of folks are asking themselves, which the rally around the flag we've seen in Russia to date, will that continue, or will Russians at some point say, the costs of this policy are not something that we're willing to pay?
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Karen Donfried. She's president of the German Marshall Fund. That's an American think tank dedicated to strengthening relations between North America and Europe. And we're coming to you from GMF headquarters in Washington. I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that Press Conference USA is also available online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. Also, we love to hear from you. Please send your feedback to PCUSA@voanews.com. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or keep up with me on Facebook. And here's a shout-out to our faithful listener, Jeremiah Kipanoi. He's a student at Daystar University in Kenya. Thanks for your comment, Jeremiah. Well, back to you, Karen Donfried, and we're talking obviously about the crisis in Ukraine, and now on to these sanctions that the United States and the European Union have imposed on Russia to try to persuade it to change its behavior. What impact do you think these sanctions are having on Putin's calculations vis-a-vis Ukraine? Are they pinching enough to begin to change behavior? How are they working?
I think the sanctions are having an effect at several levels. At one level, there's a psychological effect. My hunch is that Vladimir Putin was counting on the U.S. and Europe not being united in responding to the challenge he has set. I think he thought there would be division among Europeans and there would be division across the Atlantic. So I think the fact that we've had successive rounds of coordinated U.S.-EU sanctions is powerful in and of itself. Secondly, the sanctions themselves have been ratcheted up over time. And where we are now on the sectoral sanctions, the financial sanctions, the sanctions hitting the energy sector, the defense sanctions, including France's decision not to sell the Mistral warship to Russia, I think all of these are significant. The impacts may not be immediate, but they will be important over time. And so we have to make sure that the U.S. and the EU have the staying power to keep these sanctions in place.
Exactly, and that is the question. And you did say that France has suspended the sale of the Mistral warship, which is a key action. Let's turn now to the current association agreement. The Ukrainian parliament just approved a new EU association agreement. How does that differ from the previous one, which was then rejected by former President Yanukovych? Or is it basically the same?
Of course, there are differences, and I don't think we'll get into the details of the association agreement. But I do think that the significance of events over the past months has been to change the appetite in the European Union to engage in a significant way with Ukraine. As I mentioned, that in the run-up to the EU's Vilnius summit last November, there was even a question of how many European heads of state were going to go to that summit. And a lot of people felt that the association agreement was actually a way to prevent Ukraine from joining the EU. It was one of those way stations, well, let's negotiate this with them, because there wasn't a large desire in the EU for enlargement. You know, we have this phrase, enlargement fatigue. Because the EU has enlarged so much over the past 25 years, there's a need to actually digest those new members before they take on yet more commitments. And the actions that Russia has taken has changed the resolve in the EU. So you now see consensus among EU member states to engage and support Ukraine and help Ukraine get onto a more sustainable economic and political path. So I think it's that larger context that is important when we think about how Ukraine's relationship to the EU is developing over time, even if this is perhaps on a longer timeline. It's not going to happen tomorrow, but the outlines of Ukraine's developing relationship to the EU have become much clearer over these past months.
Now, turning to Ukraine itself, Karen, there are many challenges. Ukraine is not perfect. There's been a lot of corruption. Many reforms need to be undertaken. What are your thoughts with regard to how they are in the process of meeting these challenges? Even though they're under siege, in a sense, we are looking at upcoming parliamentary elections later in October. Do you think Ukraine is stepping up to the plate as much as it can under the circumstances?
You were right in outlining all of the challenges Ukraine faces. This has been an incredible year for Ukraine that's included tragedy, it's included some successes. I think Ukraine has moved forward quite dramatically on the democratic path. And when you think about first the election of President Poroshenko, that you actually had a free and fair election in a country that is facing the crisis Ukraine is facing. And yes, they couldn't have that election in all parts of the country, but to the extent that you were able to allow Ukrainians to voice their choice, it was a huge exercise in democracy that I would applaud. And you're right, we're now moving toward parliamentary elections. You had Ukraine sign an IMF standby agreement, which includes conditionality, an important reforms that Ukraine has to put into place. And I do believe the current government is wholly committed to that, because for them, it's the path to economic health. So huge challenges, yes, but I think we've seen a commitment on the part of the current government. And I think what's driving this is when Ukrainians look around them, they look at, for example, Poland, and say, this is a country that 25 years ago did not look that different than Ukraine. And Ukraine may even have been a bit ahead of Poland economically. And you compare them today, and because of the choices Poland made and its membership in the EU and NATO, it is in a very different and far better position politically and economically than Ukraine is. And I think that's what a majority of Ukrainians want to have the right to choose and to work toward.
Back to Russia, Karen. Of course, let's say they nominally abide by the ceasefire. They can still do a lot of damage. They could perhaps try to prevent natural gas exports to Ukraine as the winter comes up. And then, of course, there's the EU dependence on Russian energy. So looking forward, what are the challenges that Ukraine faces other than the military ones? What damage or what kind of negative actions could Russia engage in? And will there be a response from the West? And then one more question. What about helping Europeans wean themselves from dependency on Russian energy? Do you foresee the United States stepping up exports of U.S. oil or shale gas in the long run to Europe? And would that be an important part of a long-term strategy?
The energy piece is a huge part of the crisis with Russia. As you point out, EU member states, many of them are quite dependent. A country like Bulgaria is wholly dependent. A country like Germany, about 30% of its oil and gas comes from Russia. And Ukraine, of course, is dependent on Russia. And a lot of people are wondering what will happen this winter if things, rather than improving, actually become worse. Some people make the argument that really what we have here is an interdependence. Because yes, all of those European countries have an energy relationship with Russia, but Russia also depends, particularly on those EU member states, for hard currency. And so there's a question of what the damage to Russia would be of just cutting off those flows. And what you've seen the EU doing is working on what they call reverse flows, so that all the pipelines, of course, run from east to west, but creating a situation where you actually could send gas back to the east. So if Russia were to target Central and East European countries, that those in the west could actually have a reverse flow going back east.
And that's not something that the Russians could sabotage.
Oh, I'm sure there are all kinds of things the Russians could do. But it gets to whether the Russians are willing to jeopardize their energy relations with a country like Germany. If the Russians chose to cut off all energy supplies to Europe this winter, it would be very hard for Europe to replace those in the short term. You asked about LNG exports from the U.S. to Europe. But that's not a short-term answer. What folks here say is we're a couple of years away from actually being able to do that, A. And B, the U.S. has given export licenses to firms for those LNG supplies. But, of course, this is a private sector business, and energy prices are higher in Asia. So those firms presumably will be sending those LNG exports to Asia rather than Europe. There are also other opportunities in Europe. France apparently has large shale gas supplies. Poland has shale gas supplies. So I think there's going to be a mix of answers to this question. But the answer in the short term, there's no easy solution.
But hopefully the West, whether the United States and Europe, will be working on these alternatives for the longer term.
The U.S. and Europe absolutely are working on these alternatives, and there's an ongoing U.S.-EU energy dialogue, and the crisis in Ukraine has given that an incredible push. And I would say the progress over the past several months has been substantial, and everybody recognizes this problem. And if there was flagging political will before to address it, that is not the case today.
And as we conclude, Karen Donfried, what do you see are the implications of these tensions between Russia and Ukraine on the U.S.-Russian relationship? Will the United States and Russia be able to work on issues of common concern, whether it's the Ebola epidemic or fighting Islamist extremism, climate change, What do you think the impact of the tensions over Ukraine will be on these other areas of common concern?
So the interesting thing to date is that we have not seen Russia change its cooperation with the U.S. and Europe on other issues. So if you take the P5 plus one talks on Iran that are aimed at preventing Iran from developing a nuclear weapon, Russia has stayed deeply engaged in that effort. And we could give other examples as well. The question will be, does that change if a conflict gets worse? To this point, Russia has been very interested in compartmentalizing the Ukraine crisis. For the transatlantic relationship, this has been the most fundamental challenge to a shared U.S.-European strategy on the European continent since the end of the Cold War. So for the U.S. and Europe, it is questioning our core strategy on the European continent. And I think that's reminded everyone of the importance and centrality of the U.S.-European relationship. And that's why I would argue that the fact that we have stayed united in meeting Russia's challenge is important not only for the outcome in Ukraine, but also for the larger message of U.S.-European unity as we look out at the world.
And I assume that means that it's a positive sign for the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, the so-called TTIP, the new agreement that's being negotiated between the United States and Europe for a stronger trade and investment agreement.
The Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership has been the big affirmative transatlantic project. And I think the challenge that we face in Ukraine should only increase the commitment that the U.S. and its EU partners feel in wanting a successful outcome to those trade negotiations.
Karen Donfried is president of the German Marshall Fund, based here in Washington. Karen, I can't thank you enough for taking so much time and sharing your terrific insights.
Great to be here. Thanks so much.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anya Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Ted Schneider. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. From Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Press Conference USA. You can email your questions or comments about this edition of Press Conference USA to pcusa@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune to the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us again next week when another newsmaker speaks with journalists about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. We'll see you next week for another edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.